I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, our theme is what really happened in Ukraine. Was there Trump-Russian collusion, or was it a hoax? A commentary by Lawrence Sellin, S-E-L-L-I-N, will give us some deep insight into this. We're going to be showing you a chronology of actual events that we have independently confirmed is the truth, yet none of the media anywhere, right or left, have discussed this. We will. Also, a commentary from Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges is one of our leading thinkers. Chris is an extremely progressive individual, and he's concerned, deeply concerned about what has happened in the United States and to the left in particular. What happened to our liberal community? Why did they sell us out? The Great American Shakedown by Chris Hedges. And then at the last 25 minutes of our program will be two lawyers, two constitutional lawyers, one who is aligned completely to conservative values, Mark Levin, and the other is a liberal Democrat, voted for Hillary Clinton, doesn't like President Trump, Alan Dershowitz from Harvard, an emeritus professor of constitutional law at Harvard. They're going to be talking about the law, the Constitution, and impeachment. I believe that you will see that this is an extremely interesting and insightful discussion that they will be having. The trouble is right now in the United States is Trump being impeached 24/7. I'm concerned that a lot of this is simply partisan politics, much as it was when those of us were challenging George Bush's ideas of weapons of mass destruction and getting into an Iraq conflict and Barack Obama getting into the conflict in Syria and regime change in Ukraine and in Honduras and Syria and, of course, Libya. So what we're going to do, we're going to begin today by taking a look at different events that actually happened. You have not heard this in the media. This is from Lawrence Sellin, S-E-L-L-I-N. I'll quote him. This is the Ukraine was the origin of the Trump-Russia collusion hoax. Quote, during the first week of December 2015, Donald Trump began to establish a substantial lead over his Republican primary opponents. Vice President Joe Biden traveled to Ukraine to announce on December 7th a $190 million program to, quote, fight corruption in law enforcement and reform the justice sector, end quote. But behind the scenes explicitly linked a $1 billion loan guarantee to the firing of Ukrainian prosecutor Viktor Shokin, who had been investigating the energy company Burisma, which employed Biden's son, Hunter. On December 9, 2015, the reported whistleblower Eric Ciriminella held a meeting in room 236 of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building with Diane Kalinick, and executive director of the Ukrainian Anti-Corruption Action Center, which was 59% funded by Barack Obama's State Department and the International Renaissance Foundation, a George Soros organization. Also attending that meeting was Catherine Newcomb, attorney in the Criminal Division, Office of Overseas Prosecutorial Development with U.S. Department of Justice, where, among other duties, she oversaw the department's legal assistance program to Ukraine. By December 2015, Paul Manafort was undoubtedly considering approaching the Trump campaign to rejuvenate his U.S. political bona fides and mitigate the legal and financial difficulties he was experiencing at the time. From the beginning of his association with the Trump campaign, Roger Stone, a longtime Manafort partner, made a strong case to Trump to bring in Manafort, who would officially connect to the campaign immediately after the February 1, 2016 Iowa caucuses. Based on events occurring during the same period, were Obama's deep state operatives aware of Manafort's intent and already intending to use his past questionable practices and links to Russia against Trump? Such awareness of Manafort's plans could have been obtained either through FBI surveillance, which began in 2014 and ended in early 2016, or through information provided by Manafort's associates. For example, Ukrainian businessman Kelmenik, who worked for Manafort and was an FBI and Department of State asset, not a Russian agent, as later painted by the Mueller investigation. According to White House visitors' logs on January 19, 2016, the so-called modern-day whistleblower that has not been named nor interviewed in the current debacle occurring in Congress chaired a meeting of FBI, Department of Justice, and Department of State personnel, which had two main objectives. One, to coerce the Ukrainians to drop the Burisma probe, which involved Vice President Joseph Biden's son Hunter, and allow the FBI to take over the investigation, and two, to reopen a closed 2014 FBI investigation that focused heavily on GOP lobbyist Paul Manafort, whose firm long had been tied to Trump through his partner and Trump pal Roger Stone. That is, contain the investigation of Biden's son and ramp up the investigation of Paul Manafort. Again, according to White House logs, the attendees at the January 19, 2016 meeting in room 230A of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building were Eric Ciaramella, National Security Council Director for Ukraine, Liza Zentos, National Security Council Director for Eastern Europe, David G. Sakharovitz, Deputy General Prosecutor of Ukraine, also Anna Yemelinovov, Legal Specialist, U.S. Embassy, Kiev, Department of Justice Anti-Crime, and Catherine Newcomb, attorney in the Criminal Division Office of Overseas Prosecutorial Development with the U.S. Department of Justice, and Silvania Pardis, Operations Department of Justice, U.S. Embassy, Ukraine, and several others, including Jeffrey Cole, resident legal advisor at the U.S. Embassy, Ukraine, presumed to be FBI. So just 2 weeks after that meeting, on February 2nd, 2016, according to White House logs, Eric chaired a meeting in room 374 of the Eisenhower Executive Office, which seems to be a planning session to reopen an investigation of Paul Manafort. Now, just note, one of the crimes of which Manafort was accused was money laundering, an area covered by the Department of Treasury. And again, there were specific attendees there: Michael Lieberman, a Deputy Assistant Secretary, Robert Rembrandt, anti-money laundering, Justin Roiland, Special Agent, Financial Crimes, and Jose Borio, Acting Section Chief. It appears that Paul Manafort became a vehicle by which the Obama deep state operatives could link Trump to nefarious activities involving Russians, which eventually evolved into the Trump-Russian collusion hoax. Remember, the key claim of the follow-up Steele dossier, the centerpiece of the Mueller investigation, was that Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort was the focal point of a, quote, well-developed conspiracy between them, the Trump campaign, and the Russian leadership, end quote. Nellie Orr, Fusion GPS employee and wife of Department of Justice official Bruce Orr, not only worked with Christopher Steele on the so-called Trump dossier, but in May 2016 was the conduit of information to her husband and two Department of Justice prosecutors of the existence of the Black Ledger documents that contributed to Manafort's prosecution. Bruce Orr and Steele attempted to get dirt on Manafort from a Russian oligarch, Oleg Deripaska, efforts that eventually led to a September 2016 meeting in which the FBI asked Deripaska if he would provide information to prove that Manafort was helping Trump collude with Russia. The surveillance and entrapment attempts of Paul Manafort, Carter Page, George Papadopoulos, and others were designed to collect evidence about Trump without formally documenting that Trump was the target. After the election, to cover their tracks, James Comey, representing the FBI and Department of Justice, misleadingly told Trump that the investigation was about Russia and a few stray people in his campaign, but they assured him he personally was not under investigation. They lied. Donald Trump always was and still is the target of the deep state. And Lawrence Sellin, PhD, was the author of that piece. And so therefore, we now know that has not been made public is that the so-called whistleblower who came to Adam Schiff was, in point of fact, working on behalf of deep state intelligence operatives, meeting regularly with top people from Obama's Justice Department and State Department and other intelligence agencies, and they were using a trap of Manafort to bring in Trump. That's important that we know that. Why? Because it shows that we have been misled. And now all that is coming out. I don't know when this information will come out, but hopefully it will. Now I want to share some information from a very important perspective, and that is many of us, and I mean many of us, in the United States who are progressives, not affiliated, though at one time we were, myself with the liberal community, until I saw how utterly corrupt it had become when it had been put into the hands of the Clintons and Obama and others. And there are about 104 million of us. And we believe that we need to speak truth to all this going on that is just simply not in the public interest. The Democratic Party and its liberal supporters, according to Chris Hedges, are perplexed. Why? They presented hours of evidence of an impeachable offense, although they studiously avoided charging Donald Trump with impeachable offenses also carried out by Democrat presidents, including the continuation or expansion of presidential wars not declared by Congress, exercising line item veto power, playing prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner to kill individuals, including U.S. citizens, anywhere on the planet, violating due process, and misusing executive orders. And because civics is no longer taught in most American schools, they devoted a day to constitutional scholars who provided the Civics 101 case for impeachment. The liberal press, cheerleading the impeachment process, saturated the media landscape with live coverage, interminable analysis, constant character assassination of Trump, and giddy speculation. And yet, it has made no difference. Public opinion remains largely unaffected. Perhaps supporters of impeachment argue they failed to adopt the right technique. Perhaps journalists, by giving voice to opponents of impeachment, who do indeed live in a world not based upon in fact, created a false equivalency between truth and lies. Maybe, as Bill Gruskin, a professor at the Columbia University Journalism School, writes, impeachment advocates should spend $1 million to produce a kind of movie trailer for all those who did not sit through the hours of hearings to boil down the essentials of the film and provide a quick but intense insight into the characters setting the scene with vivid imagery to entice people to come back to the theater a month later for a full movie. Or perhaps they need to keep pounding away at Trump until his walls of support crumble. The liberal class and the Democratic Party leadership have failed, even after their defeat in the 2016 presidential election, to understand that they, along with the traditional Republican elites, have squandered their credibility. No one believes them, and no one should. They squandered their credibility by promising that the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, would be, as claimed by President Bill Clinton, create 200,000 new well-paying jobs per year. Instead, several million jobs were lost. They squandered it by allowing corporations to move production overseas and to hire foreign workers at daily wages that did not equal what a U.S. unionized worker made in an hour, a situation that obliterated the bargaining power of the American working class. They squandered it by allowing corporations to use the threat of offshore production to destroy unions and suppress wages, extract draconian concessions, and push millions of workers into a temporary or gig economy where there are no benefits, no job security, and pay is 60% or less of what a full-time employee in a regular economy receives. They squandered it by forcing working men and women to take two or three jobs to support a family, jacking up household debt to $1.95 trillion. They squandered it by redirecting wealth upwards, so that during the Clinton administration alone, 45% of all income growth went to the wealthiest 1%. They squandered it by wiping out small farmers in Mexico, driving some 3 million of them off their lands and forcing many to migrate in desperation to the United States. A human tide that saw the U.S. right wing and President Trump direct mounting rage toward immigrants. They squandered it by turning our great cities into urban wastelands. They squandered it by slashing welfare and social service programs. They squandered it by supporting endless feudal wars that have an overall price tag of between $5 to $7 trillion. They squandered it by setting up a surveillance system to spy on every American and then lying about it. They squandered it by creating a catering to all big banks and gutting financial regulations, precipitating the 2008 economic meltdown. They squandered it by looting the U.S. Treasury to bail out banks and financial firms guilty of massive financial crimes, ordering the Federal Reserve to hand over an estimated $29 trillion to the global financiers responsible for the crash. They squandered it by not using this staggering sum instead to provide free college tuition to every student or universal health care, repair our crumbling infrastructure, transition to clean energy, forgive student debt, raise wages, bail out underwater homeowners, form public banks to foster investments in our communities at low interest rates, provide a guaranteed minimum income, and organize a massive jobs program. Yes, they squandered it. They squandered it by cutting child assistance programs, most dramatically during the Clinton administration, resulting in 16 million children going to bed hungry every night. That's under Clinton. They squandered it by leaving over 500,000 Americans homeless on the streets on any given night. They squandered it by passing laws that keep students burdened with massive college loan debt that has climbed to $1.4 trillion. Debt they cannot free themselves of even if they declare bankruptcy. They squandered it by militarizing police and building the world's largest system of mass incarceration, one of 25% of the world's prison population. They squandered it by revoking due process and habeas corpus. They squandered it by passing massive tax cuts for the rich and the corporations, many of which, such as Amazon, pay no federal income tax, ballooning the federal deficit now at a staggering amount and climbing. They squandered it by privatizing everything from intelligence gathering to public education to swell corporate bank accounts at taxpayers' expense. They squandered it by permitting corporate money, an estimated $9.9 billion, to be spent just in this presidential election cycle on political advertising to buy politicians in a form of legalized bribery that sees corporate lobbyists write legislation and create laws. They squandered it by doing nothing to halt the looming ecocide. The problem is not messaging. The problem is the messenger. The mortal wounds inflicted on our democratic institutions are bipartisan. The traditional Republican elites are as hated as the Democratic elites. Trump is vile, imbecilic, corrupt, and incompetent. But for a largely white working class cast aside by austerity and neoliberalism, he at least taunts the elites who destroyed their communities and their lives. The shakedown that Trump clumsily attempted to orchestrate against the president of Ukraine in the hope of discrediting Joe Biden, a potential rival in the 2020 presidential election, pales beside the shakedown orchestrated by the elites who rule over America's working men and women. This shakedown took from those workers their hope and, more ominously, their hope for their children. It took from them security and a sense of place and dignity. It took from them a voice in how they were governed. It took from them their country and handed it to a cabal of global corporatists who intend to turn them into serfs. This shakedown plunged millions into despair. It led many to self-destructive opiate alcohol, drug, and gambling addictions. It led to increases in suicide, mass shootings, and hate crimes. This shakedown led to bizarre conspiracy theories and fabrications peddled by neo-fascist right-wing deceptions bolstered by the lies told by those tasked with keeping society rooted in truth and verifiable fact. This shakedown led to the end of the rule of law and the destruction of democratic institutions that, if they had continued to function, could have prevented the rise to power of a demagogue such as Trump. There is zero chance Trump will be removed from office in a trial in the Senate. The Democratic Party elites have admitted as much. They carried out, they argue, their civic and constitutional duty, but here again they lie. They picked out what was convenient to impeach Trump and left untouched the rotten system they helped create. The divisions among Americans will only widen. The hatreds will only grow. And tyranny will wrap its deadly tentacles around our throats. I'm Gary Knoll. We're here, as we are every week, on the Progressive Commentary Hour to share insights on important topics that we believe are not covered at all, or when they are biased. Let us just take a look at why the average person is frustrated. Because unlike the elites, unlike the professional class, of which there are about 17 million, highly educated, very bright men and women who are doctors and lawyers, they're scientists, they're consultants, they're CPAs, they're architects, and they have built themselves a lifestyle that is envious to anyone around the world, because we have more of the private jets, we have more of the mansions and McMansions, more people who have more money than any time in American history. And that means that we have the largest divide of income inequality in the industrialized world. And yet we're also able to buy things that we want with debt, because the more advanced you are in your career, the assumption is the better you'll be able to pay back that debt. It's one thing for a poor person to have a payday loan and end up spending 100 to 1,000% interest by the time they pay it back, and they had the payday loan because they were so poor to begin with, frequently worked 2 or 3 jobs, and still have no standard of living whatsoever. So it's easier then to give millions of Americans all the money they want because they have bought stuff. And that stuff that they purchased, that stuff that has value. And so one day a person wakes up and they've spent 30 years at a career and they have a lot of things they've accomplished. They're acknowledged in their field. Most people who are careers succeed. But they don't know how to get off that ladder. Every day it's another step up the ladder, as if somehow there's a platform, a peak, where you're able now to no longer put in those 60-hour work weeks. You're able to actually come home and enjoy your family and friends, the people who are meaningful in your life, your pets, to take time to go for walks, to have a hobby, to read those books that have been collecting dust, to go around the world and see places you haven't been, to explore cultures that would enlighten you and inspire you. But once again, someone in that family, not just the income earner, one or two, but also the child or children, they want stuff. I live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan for 53 years. I also live in the country. I've lived on farms and ranches nonstop for 50 years, animal sanctuaries. It's a simple life. Each day you get up in the morning and you have responsibilities. Among those responsibilities are taking care of the animals, making sure they're safe and well-fed and that they have love and companionship. If people think it's easy, let them try it and see how they feel after a month, 7 days a week, because you can't be negligent. You have to clean their environment. You have to create an inspiring environment, what is called an enrichment environment, because these sentient creatures get bored. But in all that effort, there is joy, there's quiet. Sitting with an animal, petting them, knowing that they're getting love, and all these are rescued. Most have been abused or neglected. Now they have a home for life, or until I can find them a home for life. And some of these, it takes a long time. But at least you know what it means to have happiness and know your place in the world. There's no confusion about that. And yet people are deeply confused about what is the meaning of their life. It's been education, careerism, family, and where is the time that they can step out of that and have quality of life? The current political system, the current media, the current corporatocracy keeps telling us that the only way we can be happy is we buy stuff. And we have to trust the people and believe the people. The politicians say, if you trust me, I'll see that you have everything you need to go as far in life as you want, have as much as you want. That's your right. And so people buy into that particular belief system. In the process, time and again, Democrat or Republican, it doesn't matter. Smooth, charismatic, charming presidents like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama betray them. And one day people wake up and they find that whatever they have is encumbered by debt. And then they try to get out of that debt. I know this for a fact because I've known people who are financial managers who tell me how much their clients earned and they spend as much as they earn or more. We're a nation that is bankrupt. We have over $230 trillion in debt, including underfunded and unfunded entitlements, student, corporate, city debt, state debt, mortgage debt, car loan debt, credit card debt. You put all that debt together, and we're about 1,200% debt to gross domestic product, which means that there's no way in the world we're going to pay it back. But we can't get off that treadmill. So we believe people. We believe the politician that tells us that everything's going to be all right. Now, that's a professional. What about the working class person? What about the person that hasn't been to college or has but can't find a job but has debt? They're in debt peonage, always concerned about who's going to be calling or showing up at their door to serve them with notice that they're in violation of their payment schedule, in some cases going to private jails. We are a nation in crisis, all classes. We're a nation confused about our own identity, both personal identity and national identity. There was a time, a long time, where we didn't have that confusion. But today we have people vying for power, and these people vying for power don't want to give any of it up. Politicians don't want, major corporations don't, NGOs don't, foundations don't. Nobody wants to give up their power. And so that means that the people who have the least amount of power are the poorest. We have over 270 million poor people in the United States now. And we're not doing anything for them. Instead, we distract ourselves. Instead of doing things like having a Marshall Plan to deal with climate change, we have nothing. Instead of getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act or reinstating the Glass-Steagall Act and getting rid of Citizens United and increasing the minimum wage and having new industrial renaissance areas of cities to de-ghettoize the city and put people back to work rather than gentrifying the neighborhood and throwing the poor people out of the neighborhood. Instead of helping farmers who are giving up farming, we're contributing to the problems. So now you want to know why some people are voting the way they are or have? It's because everything they were promised, they've received nothing. And there's no shame, either Democrat or Republican, for lying to the population. So yeah, they're angry. Here, what two constitutional attorneys, scholars, have to say about this particular impeachment.
Professor Alan Dershowitz, how are you?
Hey, it's great to see you.
It's good to meet you.
Likewise.
There seems to be this idea. I was watching some of these law professors. Honestly, I fell asleep through half of it. I was watching some of these law professors the other day, and they sounded like members of Congress. I'm just being honest about it. And they were talking about abuse of power, talking about bribery and so forth. I was listening to this. So I want to turn to you. This word bribery really has a specific meaning, and it really doesn't have the meaning that many people seem to suggest it does. It doesn't mean everything and anything, and it doesn't necessarily mean this. What does it mean?
There are four criteria. We know what treason means because treason is defined in the Constitution. Bribery, you know, we know it when we see it, when you pay a government official corruptly to perform an illegal act or an act that is motivated by money, but it can't operate when you're the president of the United States and you're conditioning or withholding money in order to make sure that a country isn't corrupt and you're asking them to investigate. That just doesn't fit any definition of bribery, common law definition of bribery, statutory definition of bribery. However you define the constitutional word bribery, it just doesn't fit. What they're trying to do is what the KGB under Lavrenti Beria said to Stalin, the dictator. I'm not comparing our country to the Soviet Union. Just want to make sure it never becomes anything like that. Beria said to Stalin, show me the man and I'll find you the crime. And that's what some of the Democrats are doing. They have Trump in their sights. They want to figure out a way of impeaching him. And they're searching for a crime. First, they came up with abuse of power. Not a crime. It's not in the Constitution. So now they're saying bribery, but they're making it up. There is no case for bribery based on, even if all the allegations against the president were to be proved, which they haven't been, but even if they were to be proved, it would not constitute the impeachable offense of bribery.
What about due process? I understand this isn't a criminal case. You have been involved in really some of the highest profile cases in the nation during the course of your career. Nobody's saying that this is a criminal case, but we do have little things, you know, like the Magna Carta coming forward, the whole notion in the Enlightenment of due process. You have a right to confront your accuser.
Right.
You have a right to have witnesses. You have a right to present evidence. So much of this has been eviscerated, at least by the House Intelligence Committee, and given a rubber stamp by the House Judiciary.
And the Judiciary Committee did it as well. They have four witnesses. Three of them represent the Democratic Party. And then only one witness was given to the Republicans, and they picked a Democrat who voted for Hillary Clinton, Jonathan Turley, who did a very good job. But why do they get three witnesses and the Republicans only get one? Why not equality? You know, Alexander Hamilton said in Federalist Paper number 65, the greatest danger would be if impeachment turned on the number of people each party had. If impeachment turns on the fact that the Democrats now have a majority in the House but not in the Senate, that would be a complete abuse of what the framers had in mind. Alexander Hamilton is misquoted all the time. He used the word political, but he didn't say the process should be political. He said the crimes, treason, bribery, high crimes, and misdemeanor, are political in nature, but the process should be nonpartisan, and nobody should be impeached and removed unless there's an overwhelming bipartisan consensus. I'm not making that up. I'm quoting Congressman Nadler when Bill Clinton was being impeached. I opposed Bill Clinton's impeachment for the same reason that I opposed Donald Trump's impeachment. There was no widespread consensus. There was no clear high crime. What Bill Clinton committed was a low crime, a crime to protect his personal life, much like Alexander Hamilton. You know, when he was Secretary of the Treasury, he committed adultery, and then he paid extortion money. But when the extortionist said, we're going to charge you with using government funds, he said, no, that would be a high crime, using government funds to pay an extortionist. And he wrote an essay admitting his adultery, admitting his payment of extortion, but denying that he paid from government funds.
Let me ask you a question. I want to go through some of these examples with you and get your take on this. More than one of the professors said this week, and it's not just them, other people too, that if this isn't an impeachable offense, this phone call, then there aren't impeachable
offenses.
That's
just nonsense.
It's absurd. Let me ask you this. John Adams, he arrested and jailed journalists. Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, shut down 300 newspapers, Civil War, arrested and jailed journalists. Woodrow Wilson a racist.
Right.
A segregationist.
Right.
Resegregated the right. government.
Yeah.
He locked up socialist opponents.
Right.
And was locked up critical journalists.
Mm-hmm.
The Espionage Act in 1970.
Right.
FDR. The internment of Japanese Americans, upheld by the Supreme Court, by the way. Also, he used the IRS against Annenberg in the Philadelphia Inquirer and Gannett newspapers. Kennedy and the IRS and his opponents. And by the way, not just Democrats, I'm giving example. LBJ, IRS, FBI, CIA, tapped the phones of his political opponent, Barry Goldwater, tapped the phones of his vice president,
who's right.
running. And we have Republican examples too. Is this a joke that the phone call by Donald Trump is the worst example that these professors and others can come up with? That's not impeachable, nothing's impeachable. Under their theory, every one of these men should have been impeached.
They have created open-ended criteria which bear no relationship to the words of the Constitution itself. And if President Trump is impeached, it will set a terrible precedent which will weaponize impeachment, and the next Democrat who gets elected will be impeached because they'll find an abuse of power. It's hard to find any president, modern president, old president, that can't be abused, can't be accused of abuse of power. I'll give you another example, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He instructs his attorney general when they arrest German saboteurs, I don't want these guys tried civilly, even though one was a U.S. citizen, and I want them electrocuted.
Mm-hmm.
Telling the attorney general how to try the case. Lincoln, much the same with suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. Opponents of a political leader, particularly during times of crisis, can always find abuse of power. If you go through the lexicon of political opposition over the years, you will find the word abuse of power used by virtually every opponent to every president. And yet, the other day when they had these hearings, all you heard about was abuse of power, abuse of authority, putting personal and partisan interests over national interests. How many foreign policy decisions have been made by presidents over the years in order to help them get reelected? If we start making that an impeachable offense, there will be no presidents left, and we'll have the English system, which is what James Madison said we don't want. In the English system, the prime minister serves at the will of the parliament. The minute the parliament says we don't have any faith in you, he's gone. Vote of no confidence. That's exactly what we didn't want to empower the Congress to do
this
in the United States.
This is a great point. Didn't Madison even say this?
Yes.
Isn't that why, when George Mason was talking about maladministration,
right.
Madison said, well, now, wait a minute. We don't want him, basically, the president, to be neutered by the House of Representatives.
That's right. And we don't want him to serve at the will. We don't want a British parliamentary system. We want a republic. And a republic requires a strong president who has to run for re-election every 4 years. That's the ultimate protection. He has to run for re-election. He only now can serve two terms. If you want to amend the Constitution to include abuse of power, fine. We had to amend the impeachment provisions once because it didn't include incapacity. When Woodrow Wilson had his stroke, he couldn't govern, and there was no procedure for removing him. So the 25th Amendment now creates a procedure. If you want to amend the Constitution to include abuse of power, I'd be opposed to that. Then amend the Constitution, but don't make it up as you go along. I think Jonathan Turley had a great phrase. He said, this is not improvisational jazz. You can't just make it up. You have to look at the words of the Constitution, and the words of the Constitution are as clear as could be. Four criteria. If they're not met, Congress does not have the power or the authority legitimately to impeach a president. Now, I'm not a supporter of Donald Trump politically. I voted for Hillary Clinton. You know what the original title for my book was? I eventually wrote a book called The Case Against Impeaching Trump, also The Case Against the Democratic House Impeaching Trump. I started writing the book when it looked like Hillary Clinton would be elected president. The Republicans said they were going to impeach her on day one. So the original title for my book was The Case Against Impeaching Hillary Clinton.
So you just changed the names.
Yeah, just the names, and I went through the book and changed some things. If I had written this book, The Case Against Impeaching Hillary Clinton, they would have built a statue to me in Martha's Vineyard. The liberals would love me, but now because the same arguments are being used in favor of President Trump, who I didn't vote for, I'm a pariah among liberals and radicals and the left.
Let me ask you about that soon, but I want to ask you this first. There's almost no talk about legislative tyranny. Can a legislature be tyrannical?
Absolutely, and they have been. Look, do you remember McCarthyism? That was legislative tyranny.
Is this legislature today tyrannical?
It could be, and if they impeach the president and they deny due process, they will be acting tyrannically. I believe that if they impeach the president on this record, they will be abusing their power and their oath of office. Maybe they can get away with it, but that doesn't mean it's the right thing.
When we return, I'm going to ask you this. Doesn't the president have a right to confront, or his lawyers to confront, if he gets to the Senate in a trial, the accuser who began all this, the so-called whistleblower? Mm-hmm. Or are we going to actually impeach a president and have a trial without him ever knowing officially who his accuser is? I'm going to ask you about that when we return. Ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, you can watch me most weeknights on Levin TV. You can join us by calling 844-LEVIN-TV, 844-LEVIN-TV, or go to blazetv.com/mark to sign up, blazetv.com/mark to sign up. And later in the program, we're going to talk about this fascinating book as well that Professor Dershowitz has written in his own defense. Professor Dershowitz, does the president, through his counsel, a Senate trial, let's say, takes place, have a right to confront his accuser?
Absolutely. It goes back to the Magna Carta. There's no concept of due process which doesn't allow an accused to confront his accuser. Whether it's in a civil context, a criminal context, a political context, any context, you have to be able to confront your accuser. You have to know who your accuser is. We don't believe in anonymous accusations in this country. Ultimately, the Chief Justice will have to rule on that because he presides over the trial in the Senate of only the president. Anybody else is impeached, you don't have the Chief Justice. They introduced a judicial element to make sure that all three branches of the government are involved in the removal of a president. So I think it would be inconceivable that you could have a trial in the Senate without the president being able to confront his accuser.
Now, you're an expert on a lot of this, and you've looked at the history. Mm-hmm. I've looked at the history. And they were concerned, the framers, that you could have an out-of-control House.
Sure.
You know, it turns over every 2 years, and they looked at the Senate, and they set up this elaborate system, didn't they? So the trial's in another body. It's in the Senate. You need 2/3 supermajority vote to convict. It's going to be overseen by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So there was some concern when they were debating about impeachment. First, they didn't want it, some of them. Then they said, we need to have it. But to have a check on the House of Representatives, wasn't there?
No question. We were terrified, the Framing Foundation leaders, terrified of a runaway democracy. That's why they originally had a Senate that was not popularly elected. It was essentially appointed by the state legislatures, who needed an amendment to change that. But the senators were supposed to be the wise old men, all men in those days, the wise old men who would serve as a check, even within the legislative branch, on the elected members of the House of Representatives. There was a debate whether or not perhaps to put the removal of a president in the hands of the Supreme Court. But some of the framers said, no, that wouldn't be right, because you can try a president after he's impeached for the crimes. And if you did that, it wouldn't be fair to have the same institution, the courts, try him after they've already impeached him. So they decided to put it in the hands of the United States Senate.
I want to ask you about this issue of subpoenas.
Mm-hmm.
Through most of our history, if Congress issued a subpoena or the equivalent of a document request or a witness request, the two branches would work it out somehow, right, some way. We've now reached a point where we have a committee of Congress, the House Intelligence Committee, before that the House Judiciary Committee, not even the whole House, not even the whole Congress. We issue a subpoena, Mr. President, and you better respond to it. You better give us everything we ask, no objections. You better give us your White House counsel. You better give us whatever we want.
Yep.
We don't want to hear attorney-client privilege, executive privilege, separation of powers.
Mm-hmm.
You give us what we want. Is that what the Constitution provides?
No, quite the opposite. I had a case many, many years ago where they subpoenaed my client in front of Congress to reveal lawyer-client privilege information. And the committee said there's no such thing as lawyer-client privilege in front of Congress. We prevailed. We won. We took it to the courts. The courts, according to Hamilton, Federalist 75, are the umpires between the excesses of the legislative branch and the executive branch. When the legislature issues a subpoena, a president's absolutely entitled to say, no, go to court. You have to get authority from the court. I'm claiming privilege. If the claim of privilege is too broad, as one of the judges recently held, then you lose. But you can't be impeached for invoking the separation of powers in our system of checks and balances. That would punish, essentially, exercising your own constitutional authority under Article 1, 2, and 3 of the Constitution. We have a three-part system of government, equal, co-equal branches, separate branches, and the courts of the umpires.
But what I seem to be hearing today from these committees and these professors is, we don't have three co-equal branches of government. We want Trump out. So today, we have one all-powerful branch of government. Tomorrow, maybe we'll have co-equal branches of government. But the fact that the president asserts his rights, and he's not the first president to do this.
No.
He's not the first president to take it to court. He's not defying a court order. He's defying a request, a demand by another elected branch and saying, you know what? I'm going to duke this out with you. And they're saying, impeachable offense, there's another count. Has this ever been done before?
No, and it's extraordinarily dangerous to do that because it denies the executive branch the power granted to it under the Constitution as a co-equal branch to challenge legislative excesses. When I was growing up, it was the liberals like me and the civil libertarians who were opposed to congressional overuse of subpoenas. It was called the McCarthy period. And we civil libertarians constantly challenged Congress, took them to court, won a lot of those cases to eliminate the excesses of legislative power during the McCarthy period. Today, the shoe's on the other foot, and it's the people on the left who are saying, legislative power, no executive power, to everything there's a season. And the Constitution was written for all seasons, not for just today or for the McCarthy period.
Where have all the civil libertarians gone?
They have disappeared. The civil libertarians, for the most part, have come from the left. The ACLU has abandoned its mission. I was on the national board of the ACLU. I was a proud member of the ACLU. During the Nixon impeachment, which I favored, I said the ACLU should be in there defending Nixon's procedural rights. I was one of those who advocated the ACLU allowing Nazis to march through Skokie. My mother was furious at me. She said, whose side are you on, the Jews or the Nazis? I said, Mom, on the side of the Constitution. She said, I'm your mother. Don't talk to me that way. You got to pick your side, the Jews or the Nazis. No, you pick the Constitution. And the civil libertarians are gone. The ACLU is dead in the water. They should be deeply involved in this issue, defending the rights of the president to due process, free speech. You know, they're claiming now that the president committed an impeachable offense by tweeting and writing and talking about how he disagreed with the ambassador to the Ukraine. Look, I think she's a great woman. I don't agree with the president, but I certainly defend his right to criticize an ambassador and to fire an ambassador. The president has a right to call an ambassador and say, you know, you contributed $1 million to my last campaign. I got somebody now who's willing to contribute $2 million. You're gone. He's in. That's how ambassadors get appointed. The idea that we start constraining the president's power to discuss ambassadors or to fire ambassadors is inconsistent with the Constitution.
Professor Dershowitz, you have said that if the president is impeached on this record, it's unconstitutional.
That's right.
Now, does the president have recourse to the courts at that point? Does he have recourse to the courts if there's a trial and a conviction, which is very unlikely? Mm-hmm. Or is there no recourse?
The answer is crystal clear. We don't know. There are arguments on both sides. Alexander Hamilton says in Federalist 75, any act of Congress that's in violation of the Constitution is void, and he talks about judicial review. On the other hand, the Constitution says the House shall be the soul and the Senate shall be the soul. There are two justices, Justice White and Justice Souter, who in dissent have suggested that in an appropriate case, there would be judicial review. For example, what if the Senate were to say, you know, we don't have two-thirds, let's just change it to 55%. There would clearly be judicial review there. The president just wouldn't leave. The president would say, you need two-thirds. You don't have two-thirds. I'm not leaving. Or what if the head of the Senate, let's assume was in control today of the Democrats, said, we don't like the Chief Justice. We're not going to have him preside. You can't just violate the Constitution. I don't see any difference between not letting the Chief Justice preside on the one hand or reducing the vote from two-thirds to 55% and ignoring the four criteria in the Constitution. They're all unconstitutional.
But this idea of judicial review of impeachment is a minority view, right?
Very much a minority view. It would not be a minority view if Hillary Clinton were being impeached. The same left people who today are attacking my position would be espousing my position if Hillary Clinton were being impeached. How do I know that? Because many of them took that view when Bill Clinton was being impeached. They failed what I call the shoe on the other foot test. If you're going to be a serious academic, you always must pass the shoe on the other foot test. That is, you must say the same thing you would be saying if the political dimensions were shifted, if it were a Democrat who were being impeached by the Republicans. Unless you can pass that test, you're not a legitimate academic.
Would it then therefore be your position now that since the House of Representatives has denied this president what past presidents who faced impeachment inquiries have had, basic fundamental fairness in terms of witnesses and representation, transparency, not secret testimony in the dungeon or wherever it's taking place, would it be your argument that he has a case now?
I think it would be a mistake to bring the case now. I think he'd have a better shot at getting judicial review if he waited and established a better record and found a clearer violation. Right now, we don't even have an impeachment. If the impeachment goes forward without any of the four criteria, that might be an appropriate time, or if he were to be convicted, which I don't think is going to happen. So I think it's much of a hypothetical at this point.
The House has basically made up the rules as it goes along. It has abandoned the rules that were in place under the Andrew Johnson impeachment. It's clearly abandoned the rules that were in place under Peter Rodino and the Democrats.
Right.
It's abandoned the rules that were in place with Henry Hyde and the Republicans and Clinton. There's no president in American history that's been treated like this, is there?
No, and of course the House does have the authority to make up its rules as they go along as the rules comply with basic due process. Due process is part of the Constitution. Every citizen, from the lowliest to the President of the United States, has the right to be treated fairly and has a right to a process that's due him. So there are limits to how far Congress can go in making it up as they go along.
You said something earlier that causes me to wonder. This process is so partisan, so abusive, that it's going to have an impact and is having an impact on our culture and on the greater body politic, that the myopic thinking of Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats right now has pulled all the Republicans together against. I've never seen the Republicans this united. You can see whether it's watching news on TV or wherever it is. They are driving a wedge in this country, honestly, that I haven't seen really since the riots of the 1960s and so forth. Do you agree or disagree?
No, I agree. I grew up during McCarthyism. I came of age during the Vietnam War. So I've seen division, but I've never seen division where people can't talk to each other. People have to have separate Thanksgivings and Christmases and Hanukkahs. You can't talk to your relatives or friends. I am a pariah on Martha's Vineyard because I take views that are inconsistent with the majority view. I've never seen a situation where there's been so much division. The Clinton impeachment caused division, but not like this. And look, there's a lot of fault to go around. I think the president is divisive. He uses words that divide as well. He fights back. He is what he is. He was elected. Everybody knew who he was. He didn't surprise anybody what he's done in office. But there's so much division on both sides that I hope we can begin to heal. And I don't see the healing process being furthered by an impeachment. I think that will further divide the country.
Professor Dershowitz, you've written a book, Guilt by Accusation, The Challenge of Proving Innocence in the Age of Me Too. You spent your entire life defending people who've been accused of criminal activity.
Right.
Some of the biggest cases, really, in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have to defend yourself in this Epstein matter. Tell us what this is about.
It's remarkable. I mean, I have been 50 years at Harvard, never had a complaint. I have a wonderful marriage. Since the day I met Jeffrey Epstein, I was introduced to him by a very distinguished lady, the Lady Rothschild, Evelyn Rothschild's wife. He was very active at Harvard. He had an office at Harvard. I met him. We had academic connections. We didn't really have much of a personal a friendship. I didn't know whether he had a brother or a mother. It was an academic friendship. And then suddenly, I get accused by a woman who I never met. And this is a woman who told the FBI who she had sex with, not me, told her boyfriend that she didn't have sex with me, told her best friend she didn't have sex with me. The FBI investigated, the former director of the FBI, and found that she was not telling the truth. Her own lawyer, in a tape-recorded conversation, said it would be impossible for you to have been in the places she said she met you. She's wrong, simply wrong.
When was this allegation made?
It was made the last day of 2014. She claimed that she remembered, after telling everybody she didn't have sex with me, she had an exchange of emails with somebody in which she said she never met me. She never met me. And then she meets her lawyers, and suddenly she remembers not only having sex with me, but on seven occasions in places that I never was during the relevant time period, even including in a car in front of my house, where she then claims she went into my house, where my wife has a office. She's a psychologist. My daughter had an au pair. We had video surveillance. Totally made up stories. And I prove it conclusively. And the question that I ask in my book are twofold. How do you protect yourself from a false accusation? I used to tell my students, if you're going to be controversial, you can't get close to lines. Pay more taxes. Don't flirt. Don't touch anybody. I live by those standards. I never flirt. I never touch anybody. I've never had an accusation, and yet I'm accused. How do you protect yourself? Then once you're accused, how do you defend yourself? Nobody has ever proved their innocence more compellingly than me. This is the only Me Too case in history where the accuser never met the accused. In every other case, they had sex. Was it consensual? There was harassment, maybe not. I never met this woman. There isn't a scintilla of evidence that we were ever in the same place at the same time, and yet people believe it. And that's why we're going to trial. We're going to have a major trial in which I'm going to call massive numbers of witnesses, including her own lawyers. This is all part of an extortion plot against Leslie Wexner. The plan was to
accuse Leslie Wexner is a billionaire.
The owner of Victoria's Secret. The plot was to accuse me publicly and then privately go to Leslie Wexner, which they did, and essentially say to him, look, if you don't want to have happen to you what happened to Dershowitz, there are ways of resolving this. And now we know the same lawyer who did this, the New York Times reported recently, was engaged in another plot which sounds very similar, to try to sell fake photographs of prominent people like Ehud Barak to Sheldon Adelson for money. And so this is all going to come out at the trial.
So you filed suit.
I'm filing suit against...
You have or you are?
I have already filed suit against the woman who accused me, and I'm planning to file suit further against some of the lawyers.
Whether you support Trump or hold Trump in utter contempt is not the issue. What is an issue is, have we just seen a three-year coup d'etat by the deep state that had Hillary Clinton or any Democrat been elected, everything would have seemed normal. But it's not. And now they're showing their hand. Since when does liberal media bring on members of the deep state as color commentaries, providers on MSNBC and CNN? It's unfortunate how far we have gone down the rabbit hole. Agree or disagree, interesting statements. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.